If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
But you know, basically, I grew up in the wine business. Like it or not, that's how I grew up.
First of all, consider that to can say that a grape variety is doing well in a specific vineyard, you need a generation minimum. Yeah.
I've had some great experiences. That's the fun part. You get to find these things. And you don't always have to drink a $50 bottle. You can find a great $12 bottle that's like, wow, that's amazing.
A lot of people think that you just grow the grapes, pick them, throw it in a tank and stomp on the grapes and hey presto, you've got wine. If it were only that simple, It's not.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 459. This week we feature Dr. Paul Anamosa, PhD, Vineyard Soil Technologies, Napa Valley. The devil may be in the details, but it could also be in the dirt. That's why winemakers need soil scientists to tell them the story of the soil. This week, we chat with Dr. Paul Anamosa, PhD, of Napa Valley. Paul has a lengthy history of helping vineyard managers and winemakers make the best out of their properties. Drink wine and play in the dirt. What more could you ask for? We are on the phone with Dr. Paul Anamosa, PhD, and Paul is the owner of Vineyard Soil Technologies, and you are a viticulturist and soil scientist, or as many people like to call you, a dirt doctor. How are you today, Paul?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
It's such an interesting area to me as a wine lover, and we're going to get to your background in a few minutes, but I'm going to ask you the dumbest question I can possibly ask you. Do you drink wine?
Yes, I do. Sometimes too much and sometimes too little, depending on what time of the day it is.
That's very good. Do you find yourself being analytical when you drink wine?
I used to, but I realized I wasn't as enjoying it as much as I probably could. So now I'm more of the a sign of I like it or I don't like it. But I no longer do descriptive analysis with it, which I used to do a lot. You know, I try to pull out cherry or Coca-Cola or chocolate mint or, you know, those kinds of nuances in wine. And I primarily drink red, or actually, quite frankly, exclusively drink red. But I don't find I do that anymore. I don't enjoy it as much. And, you know, people sometimes say, what's your favorite wine? Well, usually my favorite wine is the wine I drank with at a dinner party with four or five other guests, and we just had a rip-roaring great time.
Sure.
So I think wine is better. The enjoyment we get out of wine is in the setting rather than actually, you know, quaffing down, whatever it is that we're drinking. I know I've had great times with really bad, descriptive analysis would say it's a bad wine with many defects. And yet, you know, it did the job for us. So
that's the thing. And I really respect that attitude because it is about enjoying the moment and the wine and the friends you're with. So that's very cool. Good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you are a soil expert. And in the end, or in the beginning, I should say, this is what the wine is going to come from, what it's all about. How would you describe being a soil expert?
What I do is I try to work with vineyard growers to develop the information base they need to best manage the resource that they're given. Many years ago at this point, I was doing a soil analysis, and there was a group of camera crew up from one of the San Francisco-based television stations. And it was, you know, life in the wine country type thing. And, you know, there's a woman out there giving me interviews with microphones and all that kind of stuff and a camera guy. And she said, well, so is this soil good or bad? And I said, well, you can't really say that. It's not a matter of it being good or bad, because we can grow really nice wine from somewhat marginal to poor soils. And we can grow really bad wine from really nice soils. And so it's a lot of it is having the vineyard manager understanding what that soil is so that and coaching them to understand how it needs to be managed to get the best out of it, whether it's shallow rooted vines because there's a high rock layer, whether it's a heavy clay soil that is going to be present issues related to water availability, a lot of water availability early in the season and not much water availability late in the season, and therefore, you know, how to monitor what he's doing and how to keep the resources properly focused on what he wants out of that particular vineyard. So that's basically what I try to do, and we do that primarily through soil analysis, which is both going out in the vineyard with an excavator and digging a hole and actually looking at it. We do what's called a profile log. We make scrupulous notes of defining each horizon within the soil that we see. We then take samples from those horizons. Those go off to the chemistry lab. A lot of people think soil analysis is just to chemistry, but actually some of the most important aspect of what it is we do is from the profile logs of understanding how that soil changes with depth.
Interesting. In the process of doing these evaluations, what kind of problems do you typically run into or things that you discover?
It can range anywhere from clay. Clay is difficult. And when I say clay, I don't mean there's not just three types of soil, sand, silt, and clay. There are these combinations of all, every soil has a combination of sand, silt, and clay. And the sand, silt, and clay is just arbitrarily or, you know, scientifically developed ranges in the size of each individual particle. And sand is the biggest, anything less than 2 millimeters down to 0.2 millimeters is sand. And then there's silt, and then there's clay. And clay is about, the dimension is about 1% the dimension of a sand particle. So it's really, really small. But when you get into a soil out in the field, that soil will have a mixture of all of them, at least some of them, 1% or 2%, you know, like a Gold Ridge fine sandy loam, which is, you know, probably, you know, I don't mean to be punny here, but the gold standard of beautiful Sonoma County Pinot Noir soils is the Gold Ridge. And that'll still have 3 or 4% clay in it, but it's 60, 70% very fine sand and a little bit of silt. So it's a combination of soil particle sizes that make up the soil. So what we'll end up doing is the ones that are the most difficult are the ones that are usually on heavy clay. Either it might have a clay loam or a loam surface horizon, but you get into clay very soon after going down, you know, like clay layers at a foot, 14 mm-hmm. inches, something like that, because clay can get exceptionally hard when it gets dry, and it's difficult for roots to penetrate it. And it's also difficult for us to till it properly because clay still holds a fair amount of water in it when roots can no longer pull that water out. The ability of a root to pull water out of a soil has to do with the size of the pore. It's all a matter of physics of the attachment of that water particle sticking to the soil particle because there's a slight electrostatic bond. Electrostatic is like that kind of thing where if you rub a balloon on your hair and you put it up on the ceiling, it'll stick.
Sure.
Very weak bond, but it's that kind of bond because soil particles have a net negative charge, and water in the soil, the water molecule has a positive side and a negative side, and the positive side, which is the hydrogen, will stick to that negative side on the particle. So that force is once you get really, really small pores, it's hard to pull water out of those pores. And so even though a clay, because the particles are so small, the spaces between those particles is very small. And so even if the clay, you can feel it and it's slightly moist, it may still at that point not have enough moisture in it to give any of that water up to the vine roots. And consequently, it becomes a problem for us. The other major issue is rock. There's so many vineyards are limited to their depth by rock content. Usually if it's, 30 or 40% rock, that's good. But if it starts getting up into 80, 90, 95% rock, you just have so small amount of water holding capacity, and it's hard for the rock, for the roots to penetrate through that rock. Some of them will maybe find a crack and work their way down to 3 or 4 feet, but it can be rather limiting. So there's an awful lot of various types of what we call geomorphological the natural way that soil has formed that has become problematic, and it becomes a management issue for that vineyard manager to understand so that he can then overcome or compensate for that in the process of growing wine grapes.
I got to believe somewhere along the line during these digs, you've run into some surprises, have you?
Yes. You know, each county has a soil map. These were created originally in the early 1930s and late 1920s. And they were moderately well done, but then most of them were redone. You know, I live in Napa, and I work primarily in Napa and Sonoma counties, although I work all the, you know, up, quite frankly, all the way from Mendoza, Argentina, up into Canada. We've done projects, but most of my work, probably 80% of it's in Napa and Sonoma counties. And each county has its own map that was done by the USDA in conjunction with the state soil service. Those maps are moderately accurate at this point, especially if you're in the major agricultural zones like Napa Valley, Sonoma Valley, Alexander Valley. Those areas, they have those maps are pretty darn accurate. I know it has a line that says it's clear like clay. It probably is clear like clay. Hmm. But the map units, which we call like a clear like clay 0 to 2%, and that's written on the map, that allows for inclusions of other soils because these maps are not perfect, and the soil itself is not perfect. It's not like, you know, we look at an animal and we say, oh, what's a species? Well, a species is something that doesn't interbreed with another animal and produce viable offspring, like a donkey and a horse. You can breed them, but they don't produce viable offspring. I mean, they produce a mule. Well, with soils, it doesn't work that way. We're not actually in species of soils. They blend. There's formation areas. There's transition zones between them. And consequently, for instance, in the Napa Valley, you know, most of the Napa Valley in Oakville from, you know, just north of the Yountville all the way up into Rutherford is mapped as either bale loam or bale clay loam. Well, there's pieces of coal silt loam in there. There's Yolo loam in there. There are a lot of other soils that are in there. And so part of it is just comprehending and explaining to people that, yeah, your map says this is bale clay loam, but actually we're finding bale loam over here. We're finding Pleasanton loam over here. And right here along this creek, we're finding, you know, a cortina, which is like heavy rock, gravelly, big cobbles and gravels. So that's part of it. The other part is some of the maps are just downright wrong. We've done several projects where we went in and did the mapping, and we don't know whether it was the database that the state holds in Davis, is they pushed in the wrong number, a key punch error, or whether or not they, when they went through that area and mapped those soils, they just coincidentally hit the inclusions, the really small 10% of something within another map unit, and then thought the whole area was that particular thing. So there are issues where we get out there and say, this is really incorrect. And sometimes it's serious. We were doing a project a couple of years ago over in Sonoma County, and the soil was mapped as Gold Ridge fine sandy loam, and we got out there, and it was a Hennecke loam. And a Hennecke loam is one of these serpentine soils, and it is toxic.
Really?
And it will not grow grapevines.
Wow.
It's the only soil we consider to be unsuitable for wine grapes is the Hennecke. And there's Montara is almost the same. It's not a very good soil either. It's also a serpentine soil. There's a couple of others that are derived from serpentine, which can work, but the Hennecke is bad. So, and we found the Hennecke on that property, and you just go, okay, well, you know, luckily we were out there working with the person who was thinking of buying the property, so it was a purchaser, and we were able to alert them, this is not what you think, it's not mapped correctly, and therefore they ended up stopping the sale. They, on their, you know, during their due diligence, they said, no, we've decided we're not going to buy the property because we've determined that the map unit is incorrect and it's not soil we want. So those are the kind of things that become the surprise. Occasionally you'll find, we found shards of pottery and, you know, little flakes of arrowheads and stuff like that. Oh. But I don't consider those exceptionally surprising considering we know that, you know, a couple of hundred years ago there were thousands of people wandering around these woods.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, as long as you're not finding bodies, that's good, right?
You know, I was just talking to somebody about that. No, I've never found a body. We found pottery shards and that sort of thing, but we have found, you know, livestock. Stuff like that. We found mouse skeletons in mouse holes. One time, one of my colleagues, he got into a hole. And when we get into a hole, the excavator or backhoe will dig this hole. It's usually about 2 feet wide and 5 feet deep and maybe 8 or 10 feet long with a ramp on it. And we work on the far end of the hole. We try to have that go straight up and down so that we can take a picture of it. But also, it's not a hypotenuse. It's going vertically straight up and down. And then we have to clean off with a geology hammer. We have to clean off 2 or 3 inches of soil because the backhoe has compressed that soil during the process of digging it. Hmm. So we need to get back to the natural soil structure, the natural aggregation of the particles. Well, he was doing that, and he opened up a rodent hole. And in that rodent hole was a rattlesnake. And he said it just scared the bejesus out of him. Now, in the hole, the snake could not bite him because it couldn't coil, it couldn't jump, you know, it couldn't spring. But, and this guy was an experienced herpetologist. He had played with snakes a lot when he was a kid, poisonous snakes. But he said it was 30 minutes before his adrenaline finally went back down to the point where he could get back to work because it just flummoxed him. Now, I've never had that experience. I've seen snakes out in the field, but usually they're on the ground, on the surface, and, you know, they scurry away when they see us coming. But, yeah, there's other experiences of other people, you know, as we soil scientists get together and chat and, you know, tell lies about what we've seen and what we haven't seen over time. Is, there's a lot of stories that come up.
Yeah, I bet there's a lot of good stories. That is a good one, and that would be a disturbing one.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back to the soil in a minute, but this is interesting to talk about what you do. But let's talk about where you came from in this industry. I have to say real quick, as an aside, Anamosa is an interesting name because I pass through. My daughter lives in Iowa, so we drive past the town of Anamosa in Iowa. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, we're related. you know, the name Anamosa was the daughter of a Sioux Indian chief. And that means white fawn in Sioux. And my great grandfather immigrated from Austria. His name was Enner Moser, Enner Moser. And he immigrated during the Civil War and was immediately drafted into the Union Army and stationed in Anamosa, Iowa. Well, when they discharged him from the army, if you say the word Anamoser with a thick German accent, it comes out Anamosa.
Sure.
So they just when they discharged him, they changed the spelling of his name to Anamosa. And as far as I know, we're the only one. There is a couple of Anagosh out there, which is Indian, not American Indian, but Indian. And that's about it. Otherwise, the only Anamosas out there now are my family.
Wow, that's amazing. How rare. Well, there you go. Yeah. At least I know your town, kind of.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm not from there. Actually, I have no bloodline to that. My great-grandfather's son, my grandfather, adopted my father, his mother was divorced, and he adopted my father after he married my grandmother when my dad was about 3 or 4 years old. So there's no bloodline whatsoever, but it's an interesting story and combination of names. So.
Yeah, it's even funny just bringing it up like that. What led you to become a viticulturist and a soil scientist?
Yeah, boy, I've got an hour. I grew up in New Mexico, and I went to New Mexico State University. I started in biology, and I knew I didn't want to be a doctor or a dentist. And I didn't know what else there really was to do in the field of biology. I just was fascinated by biology. I always was. Even as a kid, I was a lizards and snakes kind of kid. I'd go out and collect all that kind of stuff. And so I started taking some horticulture classes. I was at New Mexico State University, and they had an ag school. So I took horticulture. I thought, oh, maybe I should do this. You know, this looks interesting. And, you know, agriculture is an industry, so there's always a desire or need for people that are trained. So I ended up with degrees from New Mexico State. I have a degree in biology, a bachelor's in biology, a bachelor's in chemistry, a bachelor's in pest management, and a bachelor's in agricultural biology. So I graduated with 4 bachelor's degrees. I knew I'd be going to graduate school, and from New Mexico State University, not necessarily one of your powerhouse schools, you know, having the extra degrees was going to add panache to any of my resumes that happened to cross some professor's desk and go, oh my goodness, here's a worker. You know, he's a worker bee. So therefore, we're going to get him in our graduate program. So I did that, and then when I graduated, I joined the U.S. Peace Corps, and I was an agricultural extension agent in Jamaica, primarily working on soil erosion control projects on hillsides, trying to get farmers to adopt technology where they would put in contours and bench terraces to grow their citrus, coffee, and vegetables. So I did that for 2 years, and I was fascinated at how soils changed. We were doing all these hillside ditches, so we were seeing road cuts all the time of soil. So I was fascinated at how soils change as you went around a hillside, or what changed from the top to the bottom, or where you'd hit rock, and then over here you wouldn't hit rock. So I decided to go back to school in soil chemistry. I went to University of Wisconsin and got a master's in soil chemistry, and then I wanted to get back into international development. So I went to the University of Florida and got a PhD in tropical soil fertility management. I did my dissertation research at University of Chong in Cameroon, West Africa, and taught classes over there while I was doing that. Came home, finished my degree, worked for USAID, the United States Agency for International Development, in Washington, D.C. as a fellow. I had a research fellowship, and I worked with them for 2 years, primarily doing evaluations of projects in Africa. So I would go over to Africa for 2 or 3 weeks. We'd go in and evaluate 1 or 2 of the USAID projects in a region, come home, write up our reports, and then I'd get stuck. I'd go back on another one and do it again. So during that 2 years, I was in and out of Africa about five or six times, actually. Hmm. And during that time, it was interesting. I've been evacuated twice from Africa, African cities, African war zones.
Yike.
By the French Foreign Legion, first in Rwanda in 1990, and then in Kinshasa, Zaire in 1991. But anyway, came home, did that for a while. Then I got a long-term job in Kinshasa. Unfortunately, it only lasted 2 weeks. We just barely moved there, and that's when we got evacuated because of a war. Came home again, and then I went to Dakar, Senegal for 4 years, where I worked for their National Agricultural Research Service on a USAID project. Well, during all this travel, I was going through Europe a lot because to go from the United States to Africa, you had to go through Europe. There weren't direct flights at that time. And so we'd stop off. I was always in Francophone countries because I speak French, although many French people would say I don't speak French, but I speak this butchered French.
Yeah.
And as an American, hey, it's fluent. You know, all the Americans think you're just great. You can speak French because there's so few Americans that speak anything. And some of them can't even speak English.
That's true.
And I won't go into that. At any rate, so we were going in and out. My wife and I both were going in and out of mostly France and Switzerland, either flying up to Geneva or Paris. And we would stop over, and we would go visit wine country. And, you know, at the end of the contract, my wife and I realized we wanted to come home and live in the United States. I'm not landed gentry. I had no way to make a living as a consultant. I had not had domestic consulting. You know, I had not been doing things on corn and that sort of thing. And I just couldn't figure how I could make a living on $3.40 a bushel corn as a consultant in, you know, Northwest Iowa. So what we did, we came home and I got in contact with UC Davis, Andy Walker at UC Davis, and to get into their master's program. So I got in and did a master's. I arrived in October of 1996 and then finished my master's in the spring of 97. So I did it in 1 year. By the time the year was up, I was already working for a consulting company based here in Napa. I'm doing soil analysis. And then I continued to work with them until 2004, at which point I left and set up my own company, Vineyard Soil Technology. So I span that gap between having a really strong foundation in biology, chemistry, and agriculture, and then having the soil chemistry, the soil fertility management, and now having a master's in viticulture. It just allows me to see a lot of issues that anybody with less breadth in their education may not see, because as we all know, if you're a carpenter and the only tool you have is a hammer, you know, all your problems have to be nails. So it just allows me to have a broader toolbox with which to pull from when I look at things.
You have had a very interesting life,
yeah.
And that's a great story. I should go back for 1 minute and thank Daniel Roberts, who referred you to me. We did an interview with him some months ago, a very fascinating interview, and also to mention that your business is based in Napa Valley, so not a bad place to be and not a bad place to work. Mm-hmm. So that brings me to the big question that so many people are talking about for the last decade, if not more, and that is drought. You were talking about the clay soil and the retention of water. Where are we at in terms of drought in California? I know you guys are in a tough spot,
yeah.
But how is that affecting the grapevines?
Yeah, it was very difficult. This is the this year especially. Last year was bad. Last year we got about two-thirds of the rainfall that we normally get. This year, we got only about two-fifths, so slightly less than half of the rainfall we normally get. Napa normally gets about 30 inches. You could go north to Calistoga, 26 miles north, still in the Napa Valley, the north end of the valley.
Sure.
They usually get about 42 to 45 inches. So everybody was way down, about one-third. Also, there's a concept in soil science called field capacity, and that's the amount of water that a soil will hold if it's wet, very, very wet, but allowed to drain through gravity. So for us, field capacity is the way the soils are in February and in January after we've, you know, already had two or three months of heavy rain. And we go out, you know, it rains the day before, we go out the next day. All that rainwater is pretty much drained its way through the soil, but that water that's being held by the soil is still held by the soil. So that is the field capacity. That's the maximum amount of water that the soil will hold with allowed to drain, but no evapotranspiration. And in the middle of winter, 50-degree days, we're not evaporating much water. Well, this year was the first year we went into bud break and we weren't at field capacity. It hadn't rained for 2 months.
Wow.
And the soils were already relatively dry. So the impact it had on us this year, last year wasn't quite so bad. But this year was that we had a lot of stunted growth. Vines didn't grow as big as they normally do because they didn't have as much water in the profile. And many of the managers were a little bit slow to grasp the implications of the fact that they didn't have as much water in their profile. This, again, comes back down to this, you know, vineyard managers are managers of resources and not just calendar watchers. They don't just, if you're a vineyard manager and you're just looking at the calendar, say, okay, well, we don't normally irrigate until, you know, June 20th, therefore we're not going to irrigate until June 20th. You know, in 2021, you needed to irrigate before June 20th. And there are many vineyards that went through bloom, which is, you know, 6 to 8 weeks after bud break. Usually bloom is happening about mid-May to the early June. And they had not watered, and the vines are particularly sensitive to water stress at bloom. The vines don't show water stress. You look at them, they look fine. But if they have a water stress, and there's a calculable, we can measure it. I don't want to go into the details of all the numbers and the values and stuff.
Sure.
But if that value is over a certain number, then you have too much water stress, and the flowers don't set correctly. You get scraggly clusters. You get clusters with 20 berries or 15 berries instead of clusters with 60 or 70 berries. Or you get clusters that completely fall off. If the flowers don't fertilize and you don't get a viable seed, the vine gives up on that particular berry. And sometimes we had clusters, the entire cluster turned a maroon red and then just fell off.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, so you lost yield right away. So if you look now at what's happening in Napa, I think most vineyard managers – when the harvest report comes out in March, it does every year and goes through all of the various zones throughout California and how much grapes were harvested. Napa, Sonoma, you'll probably find we're down about 30% of normal, and some growers are down 50 to 60% of normal due to the drought. Some of it is somewhat mismanagement of the water. Like I said, some people just didn't think that they needed to water as early as they probably should have. And the rest of it is either they were very stingy with their water because they had to make it stretch, or they literally flat out ran out of water. So a lot of it is either wells or reservoirs. And when we don't get our reservoirs filled in the winter from adequate rain, then they don't have enough water during the season to irrigate. And so they have to dole that water out very judiciously. And so that, again, it puts more stress on the vines, and therefore the vines don't grow as big a crop, and consequently they don't get the yields that they normally do. So it has impacted us financially. I think it's impacted us financially in that there's also more wells being dug right now or drilled, because people are having dry wells or they can't rely on a well any longer to be what it was used to be. And consequently, they're having to drill more. I had a problem investigation project, and we needed to have a well driller come out, and they said, we're booked. You know, we're just booked 5-6 months in advance at this point. Everybody needs a new well.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's some issues related to, and that's a financial issue because, you know, a 400-foot well is going to cost you $50,000. So, it just gets exorbitantly expensive to do new wells or to put in reservoirs to store water. So it's not just the reduction in yield, but it's the planning for continued water issues. So we're just hoping this drought is a cyclical 2 or 3 year thing rather than a 20 or 30 year thing.
Sure.
Or for a completely permanent change in the local climate.
Right. It's interesting. This all draws together the importance of the job of a vineyard manager, which most people really don't understand. Your job, which they're hopefully understanding from this interview, as well as the winemaker's job, this is a really cooperative idea of working together on the same team. It's very complex, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a lot of issues going in. And like we've talked about, some of it just plant physiology. Some of it's soil biology and soil physics, soil chemistry. And then you have the climate issue thrown in on top of that, and a changing climate issue on top of that. So, you know, as the great philosopher, American philosopher Yogi Berra said, it's hard to make predictions, especially predictions about the future. And we just don't know what's going to be happening with the climate. And consequently, now it's just another level of stress on everybody to go, okay, are we making adequate planning now for the potential for it getting worse in the future, so that to the point where it becomes existential for us? You know, can not necessarily for the entire industry, but for individual winemaking entities, are we going to have enough water to really grow grapes from the well that we have that's producing only, you know, 12 gallons a minute, and is that enough to water our, you know, 10 acres vineyard if we all of a sudden drop down to 6 gallons a minute in this well? Or with the temperatures going up, we're evapotranspirating more water. More water is going, the vines are needing more water because they're experiencing hotter days. And consequently, we're seeing where they're having to add, increase the amount of irrigation, not decrease it, because we just aren't, because we're evapotranspirating more. So we're getting less water in rainfall, we're evapotranspirating more, and therefore we're having to draw on our natural resources of water storage even greater. And so there's a lot of human stress, mental stress that we're going through as we try to make that kind of planning as either individuals, you know, owners or vineyard managers or groups of individuals within a winery. And there are a lot of wineries that have set up and vineyards that have set up going, okay, we're going to have a meeting today and we're going to start talking at the three or four of our brains together about how, what can we do to try to mitigate the risk of the changes that we're now seeing in both in our climate as well as the impact of that climate on groundwater availability, our wells availability, you know, that sort of thing. So it's definitely something that's a precipice on a lot of people's minds.
Sure. Getting off the science side for a moment, do you by any chance make your own wine?
No. No, I don't.
Okay.
And I don't. I probably never will. You know, I did one time, you mentioned Daniel Robertson. There was a time many years ago when Daniel and myself and about three or four other, you know, people that were kind of hung out in his orbit of social life, where we did make wine. But, you know, when you're out there buying your own grapes at the market value and you make mediocre wine with it, because, you know, we're not winemakers, and we don't have the technology that a lot of winemakers have, and we're having to do our, you know, our fermentations in open vats and all that kind of stuff. You know, it just boils down to, you know, there's a lot of technology that goes on behind those doors at a winery that, you know, most people, even, you know, if you're taking a tour, you have no idea how sophisticated it has gotten to produce these really high-quality wines. And it ended up being, well, the cost of making the wine, you know, for the amount of money that we were spending, I could just go out and buy, you know, wine just... was a lot better.
You're in Napa Valley. Why not just step out your door?
Yeah, it kind of fell by the wayside. This was actually, we were making it over at Daniel's place in Sonoma, but in Sonoma County, but it just got to the point where we were going, okay, well, the cost of doing all this, we could probably, you know, go out and get either much better wine for the same price more wine for the same price. And so therefore, you know, it kind of fell by the wayside and we don't do it anymore. But I've done it, you know, a couple of times. And when I say I've done it, I didn't do the actual winemaking. I did the bottling. You know, I know nothing, you know, really about winemaking. It was somebody else that was doing that in the group, you know, it's kind of shared acting.
Sure. Well, nature of the gig, that's, you know, I just kind of wanted to go down that path.
Yeah.
My favorite question that I ask everybody, winemakers, vineyard managers, cellar masters and everything, obviously you've done plenty of interviews. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Oh gosh. Man, you should have warned me about that one coming up. Because off the top of my head, I don't have a really a good answer. I know we can always talk about things like mineralogy and terroir, which I always find fascinating, but not so much for the concept, but for the misappropriation of terminology. I know I was at a conference International Cold Climate Conference in Ontario, Canada, a couple of years ago, and they asked me to come in and talk about what soils give to wines. And, you know, at that point, the concept of minerality had been bannered around now for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years. And I don't drink that much white wine, so I don't really taste it when I drink white wine. And quite frankly, after listening to all these people talk about it, I thought, is it really something real? And thirdly, nobody likes in science when somebody takes a term that is in your field of view, and yet it's not a term that they have that is appropriate to the way that they're using it. One of the guy that was the weed science extension agent here in Napa, he said, okay, you cannabis guys, now that you're legal, stop using our word. Don't use the word weed anymore. We want that word back.
There you go.
You know, you use cannabis, we'll use weeds, because weeds to us mean certain things.
Sure.
At any rate, during that conference, they had a talk. They had up on the on the panel, I was up on the panel, I gave my talk, and then some other winemakers, they had six winemakers come in and talk about their wines from all over the world. They were from Chile, Canada, United States. And since I had hit on this concept of minerality and that it really didn't mean anything, they had the conference had this thing where you could vote, you know, had an app on your phone and you could vote. So they had gone through some of the questions of which one of these wines was, you know, had this flavor or that flavor, and they would vote. And then there was a statistician that was immediately calculating this stuff, and they could present it to the group. And this was wine makers and wine writers. So it's people that were experienced wine people. It wasn't just an open conference for, you know, anybody that could just wander in. It was, you know, people that were attracted to wine writing primarily. And so while we were doing that, I asked the host, I said, why don't you just ask them which one of these six wines best explains the concept of minerality to them? Which one best demonstrates minerality? Hmm. Okay, there are six wines. The highest value of any of those six wines got 24% of the first place votes. Then it went 19, 18, 17, and 11. And then there was one that was six. And the one that was six, the woman said when she gave the talk about her wine, she says, this is not, we did not look for minerality in this wine. We don't think it has much. So she had already tipped her hand that she didn't think it was there. So the statistics showed that really, out of experienced people, none of them really coalesced around any one of those wines and saying, this is the most typical of minerality. Because it's like smelling, wet dog or chocolate in a wine. Well, most of us, if we can smell chocolate, most of us can probably identify that. We can smell wet dog. Who doesn't know what a wet dog smells right. like? But when you came up with a concept of minerality, nobody agreed. And then later in the conference, and later in the afternoon, they had an experiment of dosage into sparkling wine. And a woman came up and she had zero sugar in the dosage, 1.5 milligrams, 3 milligrams, 4.5 milligrams, and 6 milligrams. And they had everybody taste those wines. And we were supposed to guess which one had, you know, which dosage in it. And that, the answers were 79%, 78%, 77%, 81%. So there, three-quarters of the people were able to correctly identify which wine had which dose of sugar in it.
Interesting.
Three-quarters. And yet, when they came to the mineralogy, they couldn't agree at barely 20%.
That's funny.
And that, it was six choices. So you just go, okay, well, the concept of minerality, I think, is weakly perceived similarly throughout the wine tasting industry. So what I'm tasting and I say, oh, that's the minerality. Somebody else is tasting something else and going, oh, that's the minerality. So I would like to have our word back in soils. We use the word minerality
yeah.
All the time. I'd like to have the word back, and you guys go figure out what all those various five different flavors that you're identifying as minerality and break them down and give them a different name. Bingo. There's my rant and rave for the day.
That's okay. That was actually a very good answer, and I appreciate that. Paul, this is fascinating talking to you, and I sincerely hope we can do a follow-up interview. I'm going to do another one with Daniel eventually, but it'd be nice to talk to you again and get even into this a little deeper, no pun intended, of course. But for our listeners who'd like to learn about Vineyard Soil Technologies, your business, what you do, what is your web address so they can look you up?
Our web address is vineyardsoils.com, www.vineyardsoil.com.
Great. I suggest people look you up just if they want to get a little bit further into the idea of understanding how this whole business operates. But, Paul, thanks very much for spending the time with us today, and hopefully we'll talk soon. And meanwhile, I say take care during this whole COVID thing.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Learn more by visiting vineyardsoil.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2021.